This is Talking Business.
Joining me now is Gary Falloon, who's a Professor of Digital Education at Macquarie University. G'day, Gary. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Alan.
Now, you're most interested in the changes to education. I suppose the listeners on our Talking Business thing might be wondering why we're talking to a Professor of Education. But the fact is that you are teaching our future business leaders about all things digital, are you not?
Well, that's certainly part of the job, Alan, and my particular area is looking at how digital technologies can act in a certain way to disrupt the traditional way of educating that's been, you know, part of our school system for the last sort of 200 years. And, you know, I think it's really time we reflect on the appropriateness of the sort of methodologies that we're using to meet the needs of young people going forward in this, you know, quite crazy world sometimes that we live in.
Well, obviously, the classroom has already moved to iPads, away from blackboards to iPads. What's next? Where are we heading to, do you think, in education?
Well, you look at the future and you can see all sorts of things happening around artificial intelligence and, you know, more sophisticated feedback systems. And I think we've got a wee way to go, before we reach that kind of, some would say utopian position of having a teaching machine for every student that is able to respond to their individual needs and talents. We're certainly on the way there, but we've got a wee way to go. If you look at the sort of systems we've got at the moment, you mentioned iPads, and a lot of my research work has been looking at how devices like iPads are able to, you know, support basic literacy and numeracy skills, and particularly developing thinking capabilities in young students. And while the apps are getting there, they're not there yet. You know, the key to good learning is feedback, and not just feedback at the end of learning in terms of summative, but also while the students are actually engaged with their learning task. And most apps can't do that now. They're not there yet, but we're getting there.
That phrase, a wee way, is a dead giveaway, Gary, as to the fact that you've come from just across the ditch. When did you come and why?
I've only been here 3 months, actually, Alan, and I'm still getting to know the place. I was very lucky to win a chair of education position at Macquarie University. I was very fortunate there, and it's been great to be here and to see the different sorts of education system, you know, worldwide, looking at the Australian system. Not so different to New Zealand, but, you know, there are subtle differences around the way that curriculum's designed and assessment and so on. And, you know, looking at systems like national testing through NAPLAN, et cetera, and looking at the effects that has on, you know, classroom practices and so on. It's a very interesting contrast.
What about the comparison between New Zealand and Australia in this respect, in the way that education is progressing? Is there a difference?
Yes, there are differences. There certainly are differences. There's no question about that. But there's enough to be similar as well. Certainly there's a big thrust towards future-focused learning in the state I'm in, New South Wales. There's a keenness amongst the political and the government officials to look at the future needs of young people and to readjust or recalibrate the education system appropriate to those needs. And I think we've got to remember that if we're looking back in 20, 30 years, the world was a much more stable place, some would argue, and you could go to school and you could get a body of knowledge or information that you can turn into knowledge that's probably going to last you as long as you need. That's not the case anymore. You know, we've got plenty of information. Information is everywhere. It's the ability of young people to turn that information into productive knowledge and then use that, to solve problems and to, realise needs and opportunities. That's going to be the real capital of the future. It's not that finite body of understanding that you possess. It's how you can access the information and use that intelligently, to meet those needs and opportunities that arise in the future.
In fact, you recently wrote an article headed Rethinking Our Goals for the 21st Century, and one of the points you made was just that one, which is that it used to be the case that we'd go to school, learn something that would last our lifetime, and then get on with working, and that's no longer the case, is it? I mean, that's really the fundamental point you're making, is that you can't just do that anymore.
No, certainly not, and I think, we have to also look at the way that we assess and what we assess our students on. You mentioned the point about, what are the differences between New Zealand and maybe Australian education systems. And one of the fundamental differences, I think, is that New Zealand has national standards. Australia has national testing. They're not the same thing. The national standards system in New Zealand looks at collating information about achievement and performance using a whole lot of different measures. The NAPLAN system, the standardised testing system in Australia, tends to narrow that down into standardised test scores, which, maybe not maybe, you know, doesn't really reflect the sort of holistic nature of what is needed in terms of recognition of achievement going forward.
Well, in fact, you've said that the any effort to build a what you might call a future-focused education system is being stifled by data assessment and reporting processes. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think basically the issue is that we have curriculum pulling teachers in one direction, saying, you know, we need to foster higher order thinking skills, creativity, collaborative learning, the ability to solve ill-structured problems and so on and so forth. Yet you've got a measure of school achievement, if you like, through a single test score, which is kind of working the opposite, looking at the ability to basically recall basic procedural and factual knowledge. And, you know, we know that, you know, those procedures and those factual pieces of factual information are pretty plentiful anyway. You know, really, I think we need to recalibrate the way that we report on school achievement and individual students' achievement within that to look more at those higher-order thinking skills and those capabilities to work together rather than just produce a test score as an individual.
And a word that you've thrown into that in the article is the word ethical as well as critical and analytical. Why did you throw that in?
Well, that's a really important, you know, it's a competency, really. It's an attitude, a disposition. It's a way that you deal with other people in respectful ways. And looking at how you interact online, for argument's sake, you know, those key skills around ethical and sort of moral conduct are really, really important. And I think, you know, schools and education have an obligation to build those capabilities and those dispositions, attitudes in our young people. You know, so we don't sort of fall into the same cycle of negative kind of ethical interactions that we're seeing at the moment. And, you know, you now need to look at the problem with Trump and Kim Jong, you know, to see examples of that. And I think we need to really try to work hard against that kind of behaviour.
It often seems to me that the thing you have to learn these days, the most important thing to learn is how best to use Google.
Well, yes.
You know, I mean, because everything is there. As you say, information is not a scarce commodity anymore. There's information everywhere and you can find out anything you want.
That's correct, you know, but there are also aspects around how, you know, how you use that information on Google, you know, attributing sources for argument's sake rather than just copying and pasting information from a website into a document and calling it your own. You know, that's not an ethical and responsible use of that information.
No, but doesn't it mean that you need to now... I mean, I suppose in some ways it's the point you're making, but it possibly goes beyond that in the sense that Is there much point anymore learning anything as opposed to learning how to use the information that's available to you?
Well, you still need to know how to read and write. I mean, the basic mode of delivery of information online is still textual.
No, but is there any point, for example, learning history and knowing history when you can so easily look it up?
Well, I mean, it depends what you term as learning history. If you're sitting down looking at history and just memorising rote facts, for argument's sake, then I would argue perhaps not. But if you're using contextual information around historical happenings to get the students to research, you know, perhaps the reasons why things happen and the reasons behind them, you know, there's a different model of learning history. You can learn history just by recall, but you can learn history by analysis. And my argument really is, you know, we have an information library at our fingertips. Okay, Google was one, but you know, you've got the wide, you know, got the web. You can use the internet to communicate with experts everywhere. It's how you turn that information and you synthesize that information from different sources to find out and build intelligent knowledge. And history is a good example because, you know, you've got a mind underneath and behind the reasons things happen to really understand them. And to do that, you need to apply those higher order thinking skills, not simply just look at a particular fact and have the ability to recall that fact in a test at the end of the year. And I think there's the fundamental difference. It's the synthesis and evaluation of information and turning that information into understanding, which is deep and robust, rather than just the ability to recall. We can get information anywhere and recall it. It's the ability to translate that into knowledge, which is the critical currency going forward.
I mean, it seems to me that this has just begun in a way. I mean, I had a coffee the other day with someone who's involved with IBM's Watson artificial intelligence project, and he told me that Watson has inside it, or knows, all of Wikipedia, right? Which it blew my mind, actually. I thought, Colin, Well, I mean, you sort of think, well, what's the point? There's no possibility of any human being having that much knowledge. So you might as well just kind of give up on it.
Well, I would argue
in terms of having the knowledge.
I'd argue that Watson contains information rather than knowledge. To turn information to knowledge, you have to be able to think about it and process it and reflect upon it. You know, information sources is different to knowledge. And I think that's one of the problem we have is we're confusing the two. You know, cognitive theory suggests that if we're going to learn, we have to cognitively process it. I mean, we've all read information on a page and then at the end of it and thought, what the heck was all that about? It's simply because you couldn't link it with anything that's already inside your head. You had nothing to attach it to. So the cognitive processing of information is critical to building knowledge. Otherwise, it's simply just data. It's just information.
Yeah, well, I was also meeting the other day with somebody who's trying to become a speed reader. And he's kind of learning all these techniques for speed reading. He's plowing through book after book. And I kind of thought, and I said to him, listen, in my opinion, choose your book, read it slowly and understand it.
Yeah, I'd agree with that totally. Absolutely. Absolutely agree with that completely. Otherwise, you know, it's just flicking from page to page. And, you know, that's the problem we've got at the moment. We've got too much information for many purposes. You know, when we're getting situations with students and schools, you know, going to the first page in Wikipedia or going to the first Google site saying, oh, that must be the fact, and just downloading it, putting it into an assignment and calling it their own, maybe changing the odd word or two. You know, I mean, there's a great industry now in anti-plagiarism software. And it's become a really significant problem. I'm in a university, you know, every student submits an assignment, gets it filtered through an anti-plagiarism system. You know, and part of my job is going through looking at the filters and saying, well, you know, how have they used this particular piece of information? Is it somebody else's information? Have they attributed it correctly? What's their referencing like? Or have they done any of those things at all? And quite often you find they haven't. And it's simply, you know, they've just simply copied and pasted off a website and called it their own. And, you know, this goes back to that question around ethics and responsibility we talked about earlier.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Gary. I feel like we've just got to the nub of the matter.
Oh, we have. I tell you what, there's plenty more to deal with.
Well, perhaps another day, but it's been we have to end it there, unfortunately, but it's been good talking to you. I've been talking to Dr. Gary Falloon, who's Professor of Education, Digital Education, in the Department of Educational Studies at Macquarie University in Sydney. Thanks very much, Gary.
That's a pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.